Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, I had the incredible opportunity to sit down with Lieutenant General retired Clint Hynote. Prior to his retirement in 2023, General Hynote served as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Strategy, Integration, and Requirements at Headquarters, U.S. Air Force. Described as a disruptive strategist, General Hynote's ability to challenge underlying premises in the employment of air power is key to ensuring our doctrine is never taken as dogma and airmen stand ready to defend or change the premises on which their service is built. This was an incredible interview that is sure to inspire active debate and better hone our doctrine for the future environment. Please join us as Lieutenant General Hynote challenges our thinking on core Air Force assumptions. One of the things we like to do in this podcast is get folks thinking about doctrine and debating it, not just say this is what doctrine is. Doctrine is something that needs to be debated and constantly thought. It is definitely not dogma. So you are a world-class disruptive thinker. I'm excited to have you here. Challenge some of our assumptions, challenge what we're calling the security environment in the future, and just get folks discussing things. So thank you so much for giving us your time.
Well, Badger, it's great to be with you. I'm excited about our conversation, and we'll see how disruptive we get as we go through.
Yes, sir. Well, let's start off. Let's kind of frame the problem. On everybody's mind right now is, oh, the current and future security environment. It's changing. Character warfare has changed. And we'll use terms like contested, degraded, operationally limited environments. And we kind of throw those terms out there, but depending on what view you come from, that means different things. Some folks, that just means, oh, I'll have degraded comms. Other folks, that means I won't get my Link 16. But when we talk about it as a whole, big picture, what does the future security environment look like? What is so challenging about this?
We can talk about that on multiple levels, and maybe we will before we get done with this today. But why don't we just start with the way that battle is going to feel in the future? You know, I don't think anybody knows, but I do think that we have some pretty good guesses. It's been a while. It's been a minute since we've actually fought a peer. You know, when we think back, maybe you could make the argument that Korea was the last time that we truly had a peer-to-peer fight, and certainly in a regular style of conflict, as opposed to irregular in Vietnam and places like that, although there were some regular engagements there. But as we kind of think about what battle is going to feel like in the future, you know, we haven't had experience in this. We like to talk about how we're the most experienced combat force that we've had. And I think that in many cases, that's true. But we don't have experience fighting China or Russia. And we're preparing to fight China or Russia. And so as we think through what it might feel like, I think we start with the basics, right? War has been about friction and fog. I think we can expect friction and fog. I don't believe that those things change. But some old German guy said that we are going to experience everything in war like moving through a viscous medium. And I think that will feel true to people. I think that as much as we are going to be able to see each other in battle, and we'll get to that here in just a second, I do think that there is still fog that we must cut through. And that is not going to be something that goes away. And so people are going to feel very much that's really hard, what's going on, that they don't have all the information that they need. People are going to feel confused and chaotic because the battle space will be that way. As we kind of think through what it looks like tomorrow, we can also think through some of the characteristics that we see developing. A good example of that is what we're seeing in Ukraine right now with the fight between Ukraine and Russia. As an example, it's very difficult to move undetected in the battle space right now. And so when one moves, one exposes themselves to fires. And at the moment, that type of warfare is appearing to be ascendant, meaning that there was a time when maneuver was superior to fires, or that maneuver would set up fires, and maneuver was thought of as being one of the most important parts of a battle plan or generalship or any sort of strategy on the battlefield itself. And when we think about maneuver today, we see that maneuver cuts in lots of different ways, but it's hard to see how maneuver is allowing someone to get into a position of advantage without a tremendous amount of cost. Whereas fires, it appears to be where you can use fairly cheap fires if, as long as you have them. This is where I think Ukraine is starting to run out of fires, and that's not a good thing. But as long as you have fires, you can use fires to your advantage in ways that I think are different now, and especially true now that we can see so much on in the battle space. So in many ways, maneuver is decreasing in importance. Fires is increasing in importance. I think that's really important as we think through kind of the feel of the battle space. I think we can say that defense is becoming increasingly dominant. And what do I mean by that? I don't mean that you can't do offense or that offense is folly or anything like that. What I do mean is the cost of offense is much, much greater than the cost of defense. And that's not to say that somebody in Ukraine couldn't break through the Russian lines. I think it's possible to do that. I just think the cost of doing that is much, much greater right now than the cost of defending those lines. And when you're talking about peer-on-peer conflict, economy does matter. And it is going to matter the relative cost of certain types of tactics. And right now, it appears that defensive tactics are less costly and effective, very effective. And they're effective in negating whatever it is that the offender wants to do. And I do think that this does extend to the idea of superiority. You know, people in the land domain have generally not used the term superiority. They talk about seizing and holding territory, but generally they don't talk about land superiority in the same way we do in maritime superiority, and certainly as airmen, and air superiority. But I think that in some ways it does translate. That a superiority in the domain is pretty simply defined as you can use it for your purposes, you can deny its use for the enemy's purposes. And as we think through what superiority feels like in the future, it seems very much that establishing superiority in a particular domain, especially in the air and maritime, is much more costly than denying that superiority. This is, I think, a fundamental characteristic of the battle space in Ukraine, which is that neither side can establish air superiority. And both sides are able to deny it to a certain degree. And were one side able to get it in any sort of way, even if it was just for windows of time, it would make a huge difference in many of the things I've already discussed, things like fires and maneuver and being able to break through lines for offense versus defense and things like that. But the cost of establishing air superiority has just proven to be too high. It's just been too difficult, especially given how easy it can be to deny superiority in the air. And we're seeing the fruits of that right now in what feels like a pretty static battle space. It doesn't appear that maneuver is going to be reintroduced into the battle anytime soon by any side because of the awesome cost that's involved in making offensive maneuver work. So you might think, and I don't know that I 100% believe this yet, but I am open to the idea that in many ways from our civil war in the 1860s through World War I, that defense became a dominant feature of the battle space. It was much less costly to defend. In fact, I took my team out to a couple of Civil War battlefields just to show how, as an example, in Fredericksburg, how the South was able to defend a hill from the north, and the north just threw division after division after division, and it didn't matter. So defense was becoming dominant at that point. And then I think we see the result of that in World War I and how there was no military in the world that had the ability to overcome the dominance of defense. You saw a few technologies begin to appear by the end of the war. Those technologies included the aircraft and the tank. And those types of technologies reintroduced offense into the picture and reintroduce maneuver into the picture. And then you have the Germans who perfected that. They had combined arms maneuver, and that's where it came from. And they were able to do it in ways that were really compelling, especially at the beginning of the war. And then as we have gone through the time in our history where the Air Force has existed since 1947, I think it is fair to say that generally air power has been offense dominant. It has been much, much more costly to defend everything all the time than it has been to choose when and where you attack and go do it. And this is why I think that we saw, certainly by the end of the Cold War into the post-Cold War period and the era of precision that came with that, that offense was becoming just incredibly dominant. It was almost impossible to defend against the types of military power that we were able to produce. And now that those technologies of precision and of ISR, computing power and command and control, good command and control, good communications, as those technologies have now proliferated to all sides, I think we may be back into a time when we're looking at defense dominance. And you see this in a war of attrition that is happening in Ukraine. And I almost feel like we might find ourselves in the position of the great military powers of the late 1800s, where they looked at our civil war in the United States and they said, huh, we're not going to fight that way. And sure enough, they didn't change and the defense kept getting more and more dominant. And then they run into World War I and they don't have an answer. And it would be folly on us if we looked at the Ukraine-Russian war and said, yeah, we're going to fight differently and not take real lessons in the type of battle that's happening. And so I think that as we are looking at Ukraine and Russia and what they're dealing with, we have to at least begin to have an answer for this lack of maneuver, the ascendancy of fires, the difficulty of offense, and the high cost of establishing superiority in a domain. These are all things that I think we're going to run into, and we need to be able to have a way of dealing with that. That's where I think doctrine can come in. Yeah. But it's a different doctrine, right? Because let's just be honest. Every bit of the doctrine, and we're talking to the LeMay Center here, every bit of the doctrine at the LeMay Center was written in a time of offense dominance. For everyone, yeah, I think I can make that case. And so what are we going to do now? And so people like this are going to lead us through that. And I'm just going to sit back and read.
Absolutely. You laid so much out there. I kind of want to step it through for the listeners. The underlying assumption then, and there's a lot of work out there. The initial work, George Kester, eventually Jervis got into it as well and started talking about this offense-defense balance driven by technological change. And so the point you're making is that the technology has changed in such a way that now we're becoming defense dominant, which leads to the defensive stalemates or the offensive stalemates we saw in World War I. And so what's interesting is all of our doctrine, so as we come out of World War I, which was turning at the end, right, the tanks and aircraft had started to break the fire's dominance into a maneuver dominance. So all of our doctrine ends up getting written in World War II in a time of maneuver dominance. And so what I think is interesting is that we're not talking about one or two points or assumptions in doctrine. We are talking a core assumption and doctrine of this offense dominance. And you can read that in any services doctrine, that offenses are our main thinking point. And I think it even goes back to as far as Yomni, who also preached this offense dominance, even though he would have preceded World War I.
Well, Yomni was interpreting Napoleon. And
right.
Napoleon was ascended in a time when offense was dominant, especially maneuver, because his command and control system was so radically better than everything else. And plus, he had a lot of people. And so being able to maneuver was his signature. And Jomini is explaining that. And he's explaining it by saying offense is dominant. I think that's fair, at least somewhat of a fair interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that has continued to persist. And so these underlying assumptions or core assumptions in our doctrine is what you're challenging here, even though we don't come out and say, oh, we believe offense is dominant directly. Those underlying assumptions from everything from air superiority to sea superiority,
maritime superiority.
Thank you.
You can say sea superiority. Why not?
Yeah. And before we kind of move on more into looking at that for everybody, you talked about the relationship between maneuver and fires, but you also talked about how fires, what's enabling fires to become more dominant is this increase in information. They can see this everywhere. And so I think that's important because there's still a lot of air land battle mentality of this maneuver dominance. And the reason fires is becoming more dominant in your observation is because information is becoming more proliferated or because fires technology itself is becoming better. And I know you're going to say yes to both, but yeah, I'll ask you the question.
Well, that's a really great point. And I don't want to be a self-promoter here. I recently had the opportunity to work with General Mick Ryan from the Australian Army. He's a retired Army guy. I'm a retired Air Force guy. And we did a report for the Special Competitive Studies Project on what drones were doing in Ukraine. Basically, what we wanted to answer was, what's going on with these drones? And what does it really mean for the future of warfare? And so we looked at the drones, and the drones are really fascinating. There's just incredible amounts of activity in the uncrewed world out there with first-person video type of attacks that they're doing. And certainly, there have been some incredible innovations. But one of the things that we took away from our study, and Mick got a chance to go and actually talk to and the Ukrainians and be on the battlefield. I did not. I wish I would have. But we talked a lot about what we learned. And as we thought through what drones were really doing, we didn't think that what was going on was transformative. The drones themselves were doing some really cool things, but it didn't seem like warfare was changing because of the drones. But we found something very important. When you combined the fires ability of the drones plus some of the sensing ability of the drones, but you combined it with good command and control, so the flow of information all the way up and down the chain, so this could be all the way to the forward part of the battle space, this could be like field commanders getting really, really good information, and then you add in the fusion of the military network. Some of that would come from drones, some of that would come from all sorts of things, ELINT, things like that, all the way up to satellites and stuff. But you combine that with the civil sensors. So there are all sorts of civilian sensors out there to take advantage of. There are even some really cool programs that we have explored that are use the access to military information, sure, but what we find is the open source information has some incredible value. But when you fuse those together and you have good information flow and good command and control doctrine, then it is transformative, meaning that what is going on right now in Ukraine on the battlefront is we're seeing the trinity of civil military fusion plus good command and control flow of information all the way down to the forward commanders, plus the ability to use drones right away. I mean, within minutes, be able to employ them. And you can think of drones as fires in many cases in this trinity. And when you put those three together, it is amazing what is happening. And what it really does, what we found was it produces the opportunity for the front level commander. So this could be in our parlance, the captain that's down there commanding the company or whatever it is, that they have access to great information about their battle space. They have access to firepower, drones, and artillery, and they can use that information and use the fires so quickly. We're talking within seconds to minutes of detection to engagement. It's transformative. We've never seen anything like this in the idea of speed. We like to think of OODA loops. The many OODA loops that are happening in the battle space, they're happening at incredibly fast rates. And that's transformative, we believe. And a big part of our thinking was, what do we do in the West to take advantage of this? Because we think that maybe this favors us to a degree. And we spent some time thinking through that.
And so for the frontline commanders, just so I'm understanding your Trinity, because they have both the ability to control the fires and receive the information, is that what you mean by the effective command and control?
It's fair that one of the interesting things about air power, as we think about what air power, you know, the journey that we've been on in military air power, we have never had a situation where there was enough air power to go around. And this has led, I think, to much of our doctrine, this idea that you have to have some level of control over the air power because you just aren't going to get enough of it. Everybody's going to want it. And therefore, there's got to be some sort of, in the true sense of economics, you've got to figure out supply and demand. And there's not a market for supply and demand, so there has to be some sort of centralized control to do that. What's different is when you are talking about 10,000 drones in the battle space, everybody has drones. I mean, there's enough air power to go around, at least to some degree. And that has the potential to disrupt our doctrine like nothing we have seen. Is what happens to our doctrine when everybody has access to air power through these uncrewed drones? I think it has, and especially as they're autonomous, and now you're able to do things like one operator can control not just one drone, but 10 or 100 of these drones, a swarm. And if we're talking numbers like what we're seeing, I think it really does disrupt our doctrine. And I think we have to think through a lot of the things that we believe as we think through what it means. It could really disrupt all of our thought about airmen controlling air power, about who actually does allocate air power on behalf of the Joint Force Commander. And to me, one of the ways that this Trinity is transformative is it is disrupting all of those thoughts. And we need to be thinking through what it means for the next war, not for the last several wars.
There's something else that's happened here. We discussed what we're challenging is what is fires. And so the standard F-16 dropping a bomb is not wholly inclusive of what we're calling Air Force fires. To get to the en masse, I mean, you're including drones and a lot of other things. We interviewed Dr. Aquila not too long ago that talked about stopping to think platform-centric and starting to think weapon-centric. And so it would be a lot different if there's, you know, an F-16 or a platform or drones or anything drops off a bunch of controllable just flooding the airspace. And so the whole idea here is that to think about what fires, the way in which we traditionally think about a flying aircraft or air power, we need to open the aperture on that as well, I guess is something else to say. We're not just flooding in a bunch of F-16s loaded with bombs. We're thinking much larger in terms of what is our air power. Is that fair?
I think it is. In many ways, the concept of drones, because drones can mean so many different things, right? All the way from a small quadcopter that you can literally throw into the air with a GoPro camera, all the way up to, you know, the Global Hawk. As we're thinking through the proliferation of drones, it can really change what we think about air power. You might say that it's democratizing access to air power, meaning that instead of the higher level commanders having the call on air power. So that might be the division commander of an army formation or the JFAC himself or herself. We really have the ability, if you have 10,000 or 100,000 of these things, you have the ability for platoons to have drones. And of course, those of you who are tracking some of the latest technologies that platoons are using know that, in fact, they do using them. And as airmen, I think it is fair for us to be experts in all forms of air power. But that requires us to think past the Air Force, because right. The Marines are going to have air power. I mean, they do, right? But I mean, they're going to have a proliferation of them. So with the Army, say with the Navy, there was an article out just this last week on the Navy's envisioning 100,000 types of drones, that or 100,000 numbers up to 100,000 drones. I assume that would be underwater, on the water, and above the water. And we have to think through, as airmen, what special skill sets and special understanding do we bring with our expertise in the air when we are talking about the proliferation of air power and maybe even the democratization of air power. I think there's some really good stuff here. I don't know what all that is, but I think that's kind of what we owe the joint force, is being able to advise on the best use of air power in this time frame and not the last time frame. And that's, I think, it's going to be a lot of fun thinking through this, but probably a lot of trial and error too.
Maybe we can start a little bit of that. So back to our offense defense type of look here. We talked about it's all, a lot of our doctrine and the way we think is built upon this offense dominance. So let's maybe discuss a few things that we know in a defense dominant world, maybe some underlying principles or assumptions that we could maybe pull out, some underlying principles, assumptions on offense dominant, and then maybe some that are just universal, because you're the greater thinker here. I'm going to take the universal and I'm going to say war is a political act. I'll give that one out first. I think that's universal. Do you have something for the other two, or maybe add to that?
Oh, gosh. Well, let's start with the political act. As we think through peer competition and maybe conflict, it is pretty obvious to, I think, a lot of us that populations are still part of this competition, and that if and when we have to fight a peer competitor, that the likelihood of them assuming that our population is the center of gravity, I think, is very high. As an example, in a Taiwan scenario, I think that China would assume that the will of the Taiwanese people would be a center of gravity, and I think they'd be right. And then I think we would also think that the will of the people in China to keep fighting is a center of gravity. Now, there would be a lot of people who would say, well, it doesn't matter. The Communist Party is just going to do what the Communist Party does. I'm not sure I believe that. I'm not sure that they think that their population is so in lockstep with everything that they're doing. As we think through the Ukraine situation, it is obvious that Russia has chosen, or at least has assumed, that the will of the Ukrainian people to keep fighting is a center of gravity. And again, I think they're right on that. And clearly, there has been a use of air power to influence those populations. So as an example, this is where we get the long-range strikes that are happening. A lot of people would say, well, that just proves that offense is still applicable. And I certainly believe that. I don't want to say that the missile won't get through. By the way, I'm not sure I believe the bomber is always going to get through, but I generally believe the missile is going to get through, at least some of the missiles, right? And this gets into what it is really, I think, happening, which is the exchange rates of the of the missiles. And I do think that this matters, and this matters in cost imposition. Again, and as we're thinking through a war, these wars appear to be wars of exhaustion. I don't like that. No one wants to see Ukraine get exhausted, and that's the reason why it loses. And frankly, none of us really want to see Russia get exhausted, although I could see why people might say, oh, sure we would. But I mean, the human suffering that comes with an exhausting war is terrible. It's terrible on all sides. It's not good. But we're clearly trending from attrition to exhaustion at this point. That is very political. There is a political aspect to exhaustion. And we're watching this. We're watching this on many different levels. I won't break down all the politics of Europe, but we are definitely watching it. So as we're thinking about what it means to have a war of exhaustion, it does matter when you are shooting drones that cost $10,000 and somebody is shooting down those drones with very, very expensive surface-to-air missiles. Now, those of you who are astute know that at this moment, it's mid-February, we are watching the United States Navy in the Red Sea shoot down fairly cheap drones with really expensive missiles. And that's not great. Maybe we won't get exhausted, but I mean, the cost of that is high. And especially as we think through what we might think of as the fairly low production rates of exquisite weapons. we're seeing this a lot where it's not necessarily the offensive effects of airstrikes, maybe like lots of missile salvos, as an example, or drone salvos. What's really happening is you're running the other side out of their exquisite surface air missiles. And that is creating the ability to start establishing windows of superiority. And that's really interesting. I think that that's something we ought to notice and we ought to take notice of. And I believe that's a strategy, or at least a tactic that we ought to use in the future. That anytime that we can shoot cheap stuff and they have to shoot expensive stuff to bring it down, that's probably a good thing, not a bad thing. In fact, you really just want those cheap things to be just good enough, just threatening enough that it requires the other side to actually take action versus just taking the full brunt of the salvo. So there's a lot to unpack there as well, but we're seeing that tactic play out over and over, and I'm pretty interested in it.
What I'm seeing there is, as you kind of laid that out, I start to see in what we're defining as a defense dominant, the thing that seems to be kind of the assumption going in is the need for cheap, effective fires. As I compare that to World War I, artillery wasn't necessarily cheap, but it's a lot cheaper than having 10,000 men try to storm the battlefield and break the lines. So cheap, effective fires becomes a dominant feature for a side that wants to win. The other piece you bring out is this exhaustion. In defense, when you have a defense dominant, exhaustion seems to be the default that it'll naturally tries to go to unless you plan appropriately. And sometimes that's the strategy, is to set up, I guess, eventually exhaust your enemy or develop technology in order to bring maneuver back, such as Cambrai and the eventual invention of the tank that allowed maneuver to become dominant. So it's interesting, if we were to play this out to a future conflict, do we build the strategy of trying to find cheap, effective fires and just allowing exhaustion to happen? Or do we try to race towards technology to make maneuver dominant again? I'm pontificating. I'll let you do thinking.
Maybe I think there are a couple of different ways you could go with that. And honestly, I think we're probably going a couple of different ways on that. But let me just postulate the possibility here. So as we think about our geopolitical position, in essence, we are the superpower that would like to see the form of world order that has taken root in the last several decades. We want to see that extended. That kind of sets us up as the status quo power. Like, we're not out there looking for empires. We're certainly not out there trying to change political lines or take territory for ourselves or anything like that. We would be quite happy if the world would kind of settle down and we could just worry about economic competition, and we wouldn't have to worry about political lines changing or invasions or fighting or anything like that. So we're kind of the status quo power. Well, I think we are the status quo power. Well, then defense dominance works for us. We want the other side to exhaust itself trying to do things offensively. But I think sometimes it's easier to explain something like this if we talk about a scenario. So let's just talk about the Taiwan scenario. A lot of people want to talk about the Taiwan scenario. It's not the only one that's out there, and certainly not the only one between us and China, but it is one that illuminates a lot of things. So as we think through what it might look like if China decides to forcefully reunite with Taiwan, and we decide we don't want to see that, then one of the things that happens is China has to actually do something to make this happen. Blockade, fires, amphibious invasion, a combination of all of those, it's very likely that that happens. But if they have to go across the Taiwan Strait and establish some sense of control over the island of Taiwan, then that's the most complex military operation in all of history. Normandy was an incredibly complex operation, but space and cyber really weren't players back then. Space and cyber are going to be players this time. So you've got a complex military operation. And in many ways, the defender, so that would be us helping Taiwan. The defender, we just have to make it really, really hard. We have to make it even more difficult, more complex. They have to overcome the friction and the fog. And in many ways, defense dominance helps us there. If they have to establish control, then we have to deny control. And the cost of establishing control is much, much greater than the cost of denying control. That's favorable for us. It's favorable for deterrence. And it's favorable if we actually have to go fight. But it does mean that this idea of command and control and sensing, being able to sense and then being able to do something about it and having access to enough fires is going to be key. And if you could bring those all together and put them in place to defend Taiwan, I think it would be very deterring to China because they could not guarantee them to themselves that they would be successful in it. And then if that's true, then that's probably good for the world. We're fine with tensions. We just don't want to see a shooting war over there over Taiwan. And I do believe that we're seeing many of these technologies come together in ways that we could conceivably put them together along with Taiwan, with our friends, to be able to deny an offensive invasion and make it so difficult, so exhausting on China that they probably wouldn't choose to do it. That's what winning looks like for us. And it's important that we acknowledge that, that our job in the world is to kind of keep things the way they are.
Yeah, defense dominance favors those who wish to keep the status quo. That's a very powerful statement considering our international policy. I never thought of it so simply.
Well, let's turn that around, right? If we are, and this gets into levels, you might call this grand strategy and strategy. So on the grand strategy level, we are the status quo superpower. We don't want to see things change. We certainly don't want to see political borders change. We do want to compete economically, but we certainly don't want to kill each other. But so we're the status quo superpower. That's what favors our interest. If that's our grand strategy, then our military operation should, I mean, this is kind of fundamental. Our military operation should support the grand strategy, not the other way around. Well, let's think about the opposite way. We're the status quo superpower, and our best military operations are offensive. Mm-hmm. Well, I know what that looks like. That looks like my entire career, just about. I'll be honest, it didn't go very well. I was there. I was there in the headquarters buildings, and I was there in the air. I think our military operations in the post-Cold War period were very offensive. That we were comfortable with offense. When we had to get into something that felt like defense, we weren't comfortable. Or when we're trying to do something that felt like policing, we really weren't comfortable. And so we had a hammer and everything began to look like a nail. And therefore, well, we know how to do this. We'll just go attack. And I don't think that really helped our geostrategic position very well. So now that the technology appears to be consistent with the grand strategy, maybe that's good for us. Maybe we can become the Department of Defense again and think of it that way. I actually think that might be helpful for us as we think through what might be coming.
Since we're challenging these underlying assumptions, let's talk about something that airmen hold almost as dogma. We've alluded to it already. This idea of air superiority is the first thing we go after. That's what we do. We allow that. That allows freedom of maneuver for ground forces, which we've already kind of started to question whether or not the necessity of such a thing. But in researching for this podcast, I did a lot of reading with my office on the Battle of Britain. And the Luftwaffe spent a lot of time trying to establish air superiority, couldn't do it, or dealing with high attrition weights. And eventually they just couldn't get it, and it cost them. Meanwhile, the Royal Air Force is just point defending and utilizing their very robust air picture system to just defend wherever they have to. So doing this idea of, okay, we're just trying to deny them. And then you came out with this idea, which really ruffled some feathers, of mutual air denial. But in a defense dominance, mutual air denial versus air superiority may be something. So I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the idea behind mutual air denial and just how it ruffles feathers, but how it also fits into this defense dominant mentality.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we have talked about it, but this idea that it's easier for one side or both sides to deny, or less costly to deny, air superiority than it is to establish it. I actually think that's probably true right now. And as we think through, again, a scenario probably helps us a little bit in this right. case. And let's do the Taiwan scenario again. Okay, the fires come in and they, you know, rain down on Taiwan. The world is really mad at China because of all the killing that's happening. And they begin their invasion with an amphibious assault. And they've been practicing this. This is not conjecture. There are exercises that China does that shows that this is what they want to do. Okay, so if you gave me the option of choosing mutual air denial over the Taiwan Strait, I'd take that every day and twice on Sunday. And here's why. If you're mutually denying, it's basically a no man's land, no person's land over the Strait, but you're still going to use fires, right? You're still going to use your submarine fires. Some of that will be drone submarines. You're still going to use your surface to surface fires. You're still going to use your air to surface fires, your long range fires. And you're going to have your sensing networks that are meshed together that are going to be directing those fires. So in many cases, the Trinity is still there. You've got your civil military sensing, you've got your command and control, and you've got your access to good enough fires. And I think that is a recipe for winning. Now, there may be times and places where we want to establish superiority, and it may be worth the cost of doing that. And, you know, this gets into the idea of creating those windows of superiority. I think there are good reasons for that. An example would be if you need to have access to a lot of air to surface fires. So this would, as an example, be the one way that we've been thinking about this producing fires has been to have a bunch of missiles coming out of the back of cargo aircraft. So people call that Rapid Dragon. I'm a big fan of it. But that C-130, C-17, which has the ability to get off hundreds of fires, needs to be in position to shoot. Well, that would be a reason to create a zone of air superiority around that important asset or around several bombers at the same time so that you could get the fires and use the fires. And you would pay the cost necessary to establish that. And I believe as we're thinking through what the air superiority fighters of the future look like, I think they're pretty heavy on this concept of collaborative combat aircraft or drones, you know, air superiority drones with a few crewed fighters that allow you to sort through the chaos is, I think, why you want your crewed fighters up there and to be goalies in many cases. But you really want the Chinese fighters to be reacting to your CCAs. You want to make them go sideways and backwards because your CCAs are out there. And frankly, if you lose a few, you just don't care that much. So you get to manipulate risk in a way. You can almost use bonsai tactics every time. And that's like really good. I mean, those of us who have ever been forced, I'll talk fighter pilot for just a moment here. Those of us who have ever been forced to go against a red that is bonsai all the time, basically, we're going to the merge no matter what. And we have to, we being blue, has to execute our launch and decide tactics. It's just a pain in the you know what to try to make that work because red has the advantage of manipulating risk. Well, damn, if you can do that with CCAs, all the better. But let's do it. And I think we can. So that has the potential, CCAs, I think, does have the potential of creating a different balance when it comes to air superiority and maybe changing the balance to be a little bit more offense dominant. That is an interesting, interesting development when we talk about the manipulation of risk for air superiority and using CCAs in ways that basically they go launch and they're going to go to the merge. If China wants to fight, you know, they're going to go. And then you in your crewed fighter in the back are making the decisions on cleanup. What are we going to do and what really matters for us to take out right now? And you're making those decisions in a complex battle space. But so much of the work has been done by forcing the other side to react. And that's a good thing. I don't believe we're looking at a time when air superiority has completely been supplanted. But I do think we're at a time where the cost of air superiority does appear to be pretty high in comparison with the cost of denying that superiority. And that means something. I think it means something for us as airmen.
That's interesting. We talked earlier about the two ways to go here is to lean into the defense dominance of it, pursuing those cheap, effective fires as one technology. The other is to find the technology that allows that maneuver to become dominant again. And you've kind of outlined, you know, some things that can happen with the CCA, the evolution in that technology, AI, whatever supports it, starts to build more freedom for maneuver to overcome this. So you're right. It does appear we're pursuing both of those. One, to possibly flip the balance, at least in key areas, and then other ways in which to lean into the current defense dominance. So it's interesting. It gets more complex the more we talk.
Just to put a bow on that, where I think the most promising technologies are for reintroducing offense into the battle space are in the idea of not just a drone or a robot on the land or a drone at sea, but the use of these together will appear to the enemy as intelligent swarms. So this would be in the Ukraine battle space as an example. It would be somewhat smart robots on land operating in concert with air drones and being able to do things together that negate the defense, basically overwhelm the defense again. And now we're back to a point where you can reintroduce maneuver, reintroduce offense to the battle space.
Key on that seems to be large breakthroughs in AI. If I was to pick a single technology, I'm trying to make it simple. It's much more complicated. I see it.
Yeah. I mean, and so they can't just be totally independent of one another. There has to be some level where they're communicating with each other. I don't necessarily believe that means it has to be high bandwidth, but they have to be communicating with each other and operating as a team.
I see. I want to challenge one more assumption. We talked a lot about command and control here. The Air Force has moved to distributed control, which, depending on the listener, has a variety of meanings. The idea, one of the most fundamental elements other than the air superiority and doctrine, is the idea of a single airman controlling air power. In order to control the air, you must also have this air-mindedness, the way in which the Air Force thinks about things. I think key to that is the idea that we, because of our ability to cover vast geographic areas, the range of our weapons and platforms, we think at a theater level almost naturally. And so that key component to air-mindedness, at least in my opinion. So I wanted to give you a chance to challenge whether or not control of all air power should still be under a single airman. And I mean the operational control. Obviously, we've learned lessons in the past. There are always administrative control of a service needs to probably be in a single individual. I think that's a given. But the operational control, maybe that's something we need to look at, or is that still fundamentally true?
Well, I don't know that it ever was true. I think we need to be pretty realistic in our history. I can't think of a time when it was true that an airman controlled all air power. It wasn't true in Desert Storm. If you remember, the Navy and the Marines were like, yeah, thanks for that air tasking order. We're going to consider that a suggestion. I mean, I was in the Middle East for longer than I want to be. And it was never true that a single airman had control of the air power. And certainly not the times that I was over there. I mean, I'm not saying that it wasn't important to have that doctrine in place, but I am saying there have always been times when air power has been commanded by more than one person, more than one entity, and even deconfliction was not happening all at one place. So I think it's worthy of us just being a little realistic about that. But as we think through what the future is, because I think that's what's important, is where are we going in the future? I think one of the things we've already talked about, which is, as long as air power was scarce, it made sense for some entity to be the decider when it comes to how you were going to use that air power, because there wasn't a free market to decide. So you had unlimited demand. And believe me, at times I was the air strategist during the 2007 surge in Iraq, the demand for air power is unlimited. but your supply was always limited, right? And so you had to have some way of being a market force there. You know, how are you going to match supply to demand? Well, when the supply goes up, then it changes the equation. And it may well be that a decentralized form of control is the right way to go. And does that always mean airmen? Well, it doesn't today, because, I mean, we're certainly not seeing that on the front lines in Ukraine. The drones are being commanded and being sent by ground commanders, not air commanders. And that doesn't seem to be a bad idea. It seems like it's working in many ways. And I don't know that we would want to see a centralization of the drone war in Ukraine. I don't think that would be incredibly effective. Now, as you get more and more exquisite in the capabilities, then you have increased demand and not enough supply. And this is where deciding force needs to come to the fore. At least our doctrine has always said that should be the JFAC, and that deciding allocation and apportionment is done at the KAOC on behalf of the Joint Force Commander. And when we kind of think through what it might look like in the future, it is possible, given our investments in all domain command and control, it is possible that those exquisite assets are better used as a team with assets in other domains. So this would be, you've got your Aegis cruiser, you've got your fighters and your bombers with your intelligence and tanker assets, all airborne. They're working together to be able to accomplish something important, maybe the taking out of a Chinese surface action group that is protecting the east side of Taiwan, as an example. And then you work together with that, and maybe they're Marines that are on an island that have part of that SAG in sight with some of their surface to maritime fires. And they also have eyes on, and they're able to give some good information to the joint force. And maybe there's some Army folks with their hypersonic weapons a couple of islands over who are also in position to add. So now you're starting to see a multi-domain force come together. It's not clear to me where that command and control ought to be done. I generally think, though, that's not going to be the KAOC or the MAOC or the whatever the high-level headquarters is that we're talking about. I think that it's likely to be somewhere in between, maybe in the back of a wedge tail, maybe on the ground with a special operations unit, maybe on the deck of a ship, if that makes sense. But it's very possible now that as we thought about the centralized control of air power in the past, that we're going to think about the centralized control of exquisite joint power in the future, meaning that the high-end stuff needs to be controlled by the Joint Force Commander in some way, and that may well be an operations center, an operations team that is more or less forward deployed, or at least deployed in a way that line of sight can still matter. If that's true, then I do think that air-mindedness becomes something that feels like force-mindedness or theater-mindedness, or right. You know, there's something that happens with geography here that does come together, that you do have to think big. You're not thinking about 100 yards downrange. You're thinking about the theater level. And that matters. And the joint force is going to want people who are thinking at the theater level. But it's not clear to me it's all about the air. What it seems like, it's all about how these exquisite assets mix together to accomplish the most important effects. So in a Taiwan scenario, if your job is to sink the Chinese Navy, let's all go and figure out how to sink the Chinese Navy together. That might be a JFAC-led mission, but more than likely it's a joint force-led mission. And you're going to adapt your command and control to use all of your assets together. And that's probably joint. It probably looks like a joint team that commands in all domains.
It's interesting, as you were saying that, I was imagining your triad. You call it a civil mill, but you're really talking about the information flow there, and then the C2 and the fires. And it seems it depends upon the fires. So if it's this exquisite asset, then we're looking at more of a centralized C2 where we want to get the info to the C2. But if it's a fires that's less exquisite and more abundant, you want to get the C2 to the info, whereas we had always kind of try to get the info up to our C2 chain. So we're literally talking about shortening the leg of that triangle, get the C2 closer to the information as opposed to try to always flow the information to the C2. Again, overly simplified. Well, sir, this has been fantastic. Hopefully we've been able to challenge some of the thinking. Whether airmen listening agree or disagree, I think that disruptive thinking, a lot of stuff that you brought up, if nothing else, challenges people to reaffirm what they believe in and why they believe in it. And then maybe they go, okay, these aren't true anymore. It's time to rethink this. So I want to thank you for being here. I got one last question for you, just kind of big picture. So our primary audience, at least those we aim for, is the senior NCOs and the FGOs. Of course, airmen of all ranks can listen and take something away from this. What they're feeling right now, and I think there's a lot of anxiety in the force, there's a lot of change, trying to get your head wrapped around change. So what are kind of some of the things they need to be thinking about to make changes at their level and to just try to take this in? Because a lot of this feels academic, but it is also very applicable. So what's your kind of your message for them? What are your big thoughts if you're a guy right now either going into squadron command or leading at the squadron level, group level?
Well, Badger, it's great that you asked that. Before I retired, I got a chance to teach all the wing commanders and group commanders as they were getting ready to go to their assignments. And it was a great opportunity for me to interact with them and maybe help them think through some things. And when we changed our doctrine to mission command, to emphasize mission command, and we changed the Air Force operating concept to do so, we believed that the culture of mission command had to permeate throughout the force in order for us to be the force we needed to be if we have to go into combat. We did believe that fog was still going to matter, that you would be cut off at times, and there would be times when initiative would have to be delegated down to a fairly low level. I mean, that would be the level of squadron command or even lower. And we talked a lot about, like, how do you develop that culture? And what do you do? And what we came up with, and what I believe, is that commanders at all levels and leaders at all levels have to create those opportunities to develop our people to be good at mission command. And what does that take? It takes understanding the intent. That is not like memorizing two sentences of a mission statement or something. That is an important point. This is not like, hey, well, we're going to deter, and if necessary, we'll defeat. Well, that's not an intent. I gave a commander's intent to the joint war game where we were trying to validate the joint war fighting concept. I was the blue commander as a 3-star. And it was 6 or 7 pages, single spaced. And everybody had to read it. And I quiz people on it. It's important to know that we're not talking about intent like some throwaway statement, that it's important that you think through what it is that we're trying to do. But at some point, you're not going to have the connectivity and you're going to have to take initiative. So how do we develop training opportunities for that? I think you actually like intentionally develop that. You intentionally exercise to that. And we're going to have lots of opportunities because the chief just talked about a lot of these exercises, the especially large scale exercises, but even small scale exercises, we can do this. And you put into those exercises times when fairly low levels of leadership have to create action, have to lead, have to react, have to take initiative. And I think this is absolutely critical, you debrief it. You don't just go, oh, that was great, or boy, that sucked, and you move on. You have to debrief the way that your subordinates exercised initiative according to an established intent, because they won't get better unless you don't, unless you do debrief. But this is our culture, right? I mean, when I was coming up, believe me, I was always the wingman that wanted to split. I was always the wingman that wanted to go attack over here because I had my fangs through the floor. I was aggressive as a pilot and I wanted to be that. I'm glad that I was allowed to be aggressive. But when I split from my flight lead, you better gosh darn believe he debriefed me or she debriefed me on what I did after I did that. First of all, it was the split decision correct? And second, when I exercised initiative, was it effective? I got debriefed a lot on that. Wasn't always good debriefs either. And it's important that we think through the same thing, all facets. So there is going to be a time when low-level leaders are going to have to exercise initiative. If we build that into our training, it gives them more opportunities to practice. And if we debrief it, it gives them opportunities to crystallize that experience. If we do that over and over and over and over, we have a chance of developing a mission command culture that will be unstoppable when we have to go fight. It will be like nothing they have because they don't have this. And that's why it's good. That's why we do it, is we want to be at that level. This is the new realistic training. Red flag was our ace in the hole. Red flag was our superpower. We decided we were going to be committed to realistic training so that our people got the feel of combat before combat happened. The feel of combat in the future is going to feel like mission command, and we need to recapture it.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to Lieutenant General Highnote, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our guests and hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.